10 o'clock.
From the Radio Catskill Studios in Liberty, New York, this is Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izar. Happy Saturday. It is the first Saturday of July, and also happy 4th of July, everyone. On today's show, we are kicking things off with a special 4th of July segment with Rosie Starr. Rosie headed down to the Fort Delaware Museum in Narrowsburg to learn about what life and food was like in the 18th century for Delaware settlers.
Well, this they called Connecticut field squash. We know it as pumpkins, and they grew a lot of that, not to make jack-o'-lanterns, of course, but to eat it.
Radio Catskill's Olivia Sipple heads down to Bashak Hill on a beautiful kayak paddle. And what you need to know to stay safe and have fun on your next trip to the Delaware River. All of that and Keith Hubbard's Star Talk report, but first, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. President Trump kicked off the nation's 250th birthday celebration with a speech at Mount Rushmore in South Dakota last night. Trump used the address to urge Republicans to back his legislative agenda ahead of this year's midterm elections.
We can only lose the midterms if we allow ourselves to lose the midterms, if we are foolish, stupid, and unwise. But if we terminate the filibuster, as we should do, and immediately vote for the Save America Act, then we will not lose.
The 4th of July celebration moves to Washington, D.C. today, where crowds are expected on the National Mall for concerts, military flyovers, and the annual fireworks display. The president will address the crowd as a part of the administration's Freedom 250 celebration. A heat wave is affecting many parts of the United States this 4th of July. NPR's Cindy Lupkin reports hospitals are preparing for an increase in visits to the emergency room.
In this past week, Dr. Ryan Stanton has seen two golfers, two gardeners, an airport worker, and a couple of construction workers in his Lexington, Kentucky ER with heat-related illness.
It's been a little bit of everybody, and I know everybody wants to get out there and enjoy this time of year, but boy, it is. If it were a dry heat, then maybe a little bit better, but it is not in most of the country. It is a wet, humid blanket.
Stanton is the president-elect of the American College of Emergency Physicians. He says humidity makes it harder for our bodies to handle the heat. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, you can protect yourself by staying in air conditioning as much as possible and drinking plenty of fluids. If someone around you is experiencing severe overheating called heat stroke, call 911. Sydney Lupkin, NPR News.
New research finds that certain parenting practices affect teen use of screens and social media. NPR's Ritu Chatterjee reports the study followed nearly 8,000 young people across the U.S.
The researchers found that when parents use a screen-based device in front of their kids, their teen is more likely to have higher screen time and addictive use of social media. More than a third of families said they watch a screen during mealtimes, which was in turn linked to higher teen screen time. And nearly half of all teens said they have access to a screen in bed, which was also associated with more time spent on smartphones. The researchers recommend establishing family rules around screen time, including removing screen-based devices during meals and at bedtime, and that parents should also follow those rules to support healthier screen habits in their teenagers. Ritu Chatterjee, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News from Washington.
This is Radio Catskill. I'm Jason Dole, and we hope you're having a safe and festive holiday weekend. This Independence Day marks 250 years since the Declaration of Independence, which rejected the tyranny of a king, justified the start of a new independent nation, and asserted fundamental rights. The Declaration of Independence was adopted the fourth day of July, 1776, and that evening, John Hancock ordered printer John Dunlap to make copies of the Declaration, and about 200 were hastily printed. Word spread. So when independence was declared, no one knew until the press worked through the night. The famous spirit of 76 was the excitement of people fighting for high ideals, of a people declaring self-governance, a sense of courage and civic duty. And that spirit came as much from printers like John Dunlap as it did from landowners debating in the Continental Congress or working men fighting in the fields. And that spirit lives on here at Radio Catskill. Not just on Independence Day, but every day, because you can't have liberty without information and the freedom to share it with your neighbors. Discussion, debate, and education are necessary to pursue life, liberty, and happiness. And you can't have an independent government of the people if the people are in the dark. It's been 1 year since Congress rescinded public funds already promised to public media outlets like ours, but we are still here, free and independent, keeping folks informed, keeping democracy healthy, thanks to listeners like you who are standing up for what's right. Please, stand with us today. Make a donation to keep public media free and available. Go to WJFFradio.org or donate on the Radio Catskill mobile app.
News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the William and Flora Hewlett Foundation, investing in creative thinkers and problem solvers who help people, communities, and the planet flourish. More information is available at Hewlett.org.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Will-O-Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange, Sullivan, and Rockland, a publicly supported philanthropic institution. Information at CFOSRNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Welcome back to Farm and Country. I'm Kimberly Izarm. So if you have been up here in our region the past few days, you know that we just made it through our first heat wave of the summer. Oof, I hope that everyone stayed safe and cool. I get kind of very grumpy in the heat, as I was telling my coworkers. So hopefully everyone is feeling healthy and well going into the long weekend. Just a quick recap, AccuWeather called it a heat dome that could have affected nearly 250 million people. And looking ahead, as the heat dome begins to weaken this weekend, some scattered thunderstorms and high humidity are expected through the holiday weekend. So just a reminder to stay cool and hydrated, have a weather plan if you're planning on being outdoors or inside, and check in on vulnerable populations. So moving right along, we have a special 4th of July story brought to you by the one and only Rosie Starr. Inspired by the historic marker Cushetunk Settlement along the Delaware River, Rosie spent a day at Fort Delaware Museum in Narrowsburg. The History Museum details the life of Delaware settlers from the 18th century, including the greener side of life back then. She spoke with Delaware Company members Mike Freeland, Daniel Lopez, and Glenn Pontier, who guide us through the vegetable garden and apothecary.
Fort Delaware and its museum are an authentic depiction of the life of the Delaware Company pioneers who settled in the Upper Delaware Valley in 1754. Located in Sullivan County on Route 97, the fort is a reconstruction of the original frontier settlement of the Cushetunk Settlement on the Delaware River, visually described as a place of redstone hills by the indigenous Lenape Indians. The fort is owned and maintained by Sullivan County through its parks departments, recreation and beautification. It's operated by the Delaware Company, a modern nonprofit whose mission is to promote and support the history and historic landmarks of the Upper Delaware River Valley. The original settlers were farmers who came primarily from central Connecticut and were of English descent. In 1754, the original Delaware Company purchased land from the Lenape Indians and signed a deed. The fort was never used as a military post, but only for civilian protection. Visitors now can explore a sample of daily life of the wilderness settlers through exhibits, crafts, demonstrations, and tours. For Farm and Country, I took a look at their garden and apothecary and spoke with present-day Delaware Company staff who shared a bit of this 18th century history.
I'm Mike Freeland. I'm a docent at the garden at Fort Delaware. The fort is a replica of the original lower fort, and we grow a lot of things. Some things they learned from the Native Americans and some things they brought with them from Europe. This replica is right along the Delaware River. The original would have been on the Pennsylvania side, a few miles north of here. But this is the display we have now.
Describe where we're standing right here.
We're actually standing right outside the front of the fort where we have our small sample garden. Their gardens would have been huge, acres and acres per family. Their families were quite large. They had to grow everything they were going to use for all year and seeds for the next year. So.
Okay, well, it looks very colorful right now. Describe what we see so far here.
We have some marigolds. They had marigolds here. We brought over from Europe, the seeds. They attract pollinators to the garden, and the scent of the marigolds keeps a lot of pest insects away. And not only that, they can use the flowers as they fade to, they boil them up and make dye for the linen and wool.
And what's next here? It looks like something green.
Right here we have some radishes, and next to that onions, and then we have beets and carrots. They grew a lot of root crops because they stored really well in their root cellars. They either had to dry the food or store it in the root cellar. So a lot of dried food, beans, corn, so on, are root crops.
And behind us here,
this is a little medicinal garden. Each family would have one, and it contains a lot of the plants they use for various medicinal purposes, like bee balm and coneflower for respiratory issues, and mints and lemon balm and sage and thyme for stomach and intestinal issues. They even have lamb's ear for what we would use for Band-Aids to stop bleeding, and comfrey and yarrow to get rid of infection and cuts and for sore joints and so on.
It's a very pollinator-friendly garden. The bees are humming around, and that's a real good sign. Do you know if they kept bees? Do they make honey?
Not that I know of. They did use honey, but I think they went out and found it. I don't think they had any beehives that they had.
Okay, they would have been wild. That's very nice. Now, describe the structures that these garden beds are in.
This is called a wattle fence. It was made by pounding posts every couple of feet and weaving in branches and saplings that they had cut down when they were clearing the fields. The nice thing about these, they require no nails, and in those days, each nail had to be made by hand by the blacksmith, so they were quite expensive.
Now, let's get back to a little bit of the social history of the time. I know that the colonists lived among the Lenapes, and they shared the experience. I understand the Lenapes also were very influential in gardens.
Corn, beans, and squash. Those are the three sisters. They learned how to grow them from the natives. They would make the mounds and plant corn. And when it got about a foot tall, they would plant beans. And then the beans grow up the corn stalks as they grow. And the squash grows all in between, keeping the soil moist and the weeds down. Scientifically, we know that the beans take nitrogen from the air and put it in the soil, and the other crops use it so the soil wouldn't wear out. Mm-hmm. The natives didn't understand the nitrogen part. They didn't know it. They just knew it worked from experience.
Mm-hmm. Now, there's another gentleman standing here with me. Would you introduce yourself and tell us what your part is in this garden?
This is Daniel Lopez. My role is to weed and water the garden early in the morning because that's what a farmer did in a day.
Did you say weed? Tell us about this weeding. What did they do? What do you do with the weeds after you pull them?
Well, I would pile them up and would sometimes put them in the wheelbarrow and push the wheelbarrow into the pile where other weeds are in the back of the fort. And mostly the kids will also be doing their work in the garden. They too would weed and water the garden early in the morning.
That sounds good. Keep the kids busy with chores. Tell us about watering. Now, there weren't hoses, I don't believe, back then. Or if they had rain, they might have had rain barrels. What about that?
So they would let the rain do a job, but during the day, they'll have their children to go and pick up the buckets and go to the Delaware River to pick up water.
That sounds like a good way to source the water. Let's talk a little bit about the history here and what it's like to be on the staff here in the summer when there's lots of tours and folks asking questions.
The fort itself was built in the 1950s as a replica of the older fort, which no longer exists. We get a lot of people here in the summer, a lot of people from other countries even come to visit the fort to find out about U.S. history. people really don't know a lot about this period of history in this area. So it's nice to be able to share that with them.
Mm-hmm. And what is your experience like?
I feel this is my first time giving people a tour inside the fort.
Danielle, what else would you like to add to this about the history of how the colonists lived with this garden or anything about the life back then?
So in the Cushatunk settlement, family will have 4 to 5 acres of Indian corn. Some have 2, some have 3 acres of Indian corn.
That amount of corn was to feed their families?
Yes.
A lot of what we know has been done through research, like through different records and stuff, but they were farmers and they didn't always write down what they did every day because it was so common. Who wouldn't know what you planted or whatever? So some of the things we know about are from the Connecticut settlers, what they would have brought with them. They grew things in Connecticut, they would have brought the seeds here and grown the same thing. And others, we find records from like after the war, people are petitioning the government for, you know, compensation for ruined crops during the war. So then we know the kinds of things they grew because they were asking for compensation.
Okay, that's very interesting, thinking about stuff like that. Now, how about now? In present time, gardens are often plagued upon by little critters. I'm sure there were critters back then.
Oh, yes. As we have, squirrels, chipmunks, woodchucks, rabbits. What else have we had in here? The deer come in here. And they say there's more deer here today because we've gotten rid of a lot of the predators for the deer. But we do have a problem with that. I mean, they would have shot the animals and eaten them, you know, but we can't do that here now. So we also have insect pests that we try to keep under control, too. I think it would have been a little easier for them because the families had many kids out in the garden working, so the animals would have stayed away, whereas we're only here part of the week, and so sometimes we have a little bit more of a problem than they had.
Maybe some slingshots were used.
Could be.
We said that the typical garden inspired by the Lenape was corn, squash, and beans. And what are we looking at over here?
Well, this they called Connecticut field squash. We know it as pumpkins. And they grew a lot of that, not to make jack-o'-lanterns, of course, but to eat it. And this will spread and cover the whole garden, and we should get quite a few pumpkins from that. They used them in soups and stews, and sometimes maybe even dried them to have over the winter to add to recipes. This is just a little sample to show people the kinds of things they grew. So if you come visit the fort, you see a little bit of what they grew. And they actually grew probably more spices and herbs and things than we have room for here. But the more we learn, and every year we try to plant a few different things, spice things up a little bit. Pardon the pun.
I like that. Sullivan County historian John Conway is a founding member of the present-day Delaware Company. He suggested I poke my head into the apothecary to get a glimpse of 18th century natural medicine.
The doctor in?
The doctor is in.
I'm standing under a sign that says, Dr. Nathaniel Evans, apothecary, tonics and elixirs. So let's go in here and find out.
This is the 18th century.
Okay.
250 years ago, 17, think of it as the American Revolutionary era. Mm-hmm. And this is the medicine.
Tell us your role here at Fort Delaware with the Delaware Company. Inside this room, there's lots of things hanging from the ceiling. So what goes on in here? And tell us who you are.
My name is Glenn Pontier, and I'm the docent that talks about health and medicine in the 18th century. And this is the apothecary, which is where people would come to buy their medicine. Think pharmacy. It's the same thing. It was also where the doctor hung out. And so I tell the story of a doctor named Nat Evans. And the history of medicine is complex. But let me say there were two doctors in this settlement. And the first one was a man named John Calkin. These are real people. Many people might know Calkin Creek and the Calkin family. And John Calkin had been to medical school, and he practiced a form of medicine called humorism. And this is what was taught in medical schools. He was a medical doctor. And that's the belief that in the body there are four fluids. And when these fluids get out of balance, that's why you get sick. This leads to things like bloodletting. Listeners might have heard of doctors come in and they cut into a vein and they take blood out to make you healthy. This is the dominant theory of medicine for thousands of years. Does it help? No. This is not a sophisticated way to treat health. So that's the first doctor. The second doctor was a guy named Nat Evans, as I said. And his story is different. He never went to medical school. He was part Lenape, and the Lenape were the indigenous people that lived here before the settlers came. And they were skilled in medicine. All right, so it's said that the Lenape had a remedy for every ailment until they met Europeans, which brought some diseases that they weren't familiar with. Nat Evans, who grows up in a village, learns from the Lenape medicine women all the herbal medicine. And so when he comes here, that's what he brings. He doesn't drain your blood to make you healthy. He gives you teas and tinctures and things that can actually work. And 70% of our pharmaceuticals today come from plants. And so this is the plants that they started with. And as you look around the room, you see a variety of plants hanging from the rafters. I'm drying the plants. And you dry the plants to take, you're dehydrating them, taking the water out. And that does two things. It means they don't rot, so you can store them. But more importantly, I'm concentrating the chemical. By taking the water out of the plant, what's left is the chemical in the leaf. And that's what makes medicine, the concentrated plant. And for instance, I have a little mint here that I picked this morning. It looks like a plant. It's green and hydrated and all. And what I'm going to do is dry that until it looks completely withered. And all that's left are the leaves. And I take some of those leaves and I stick them in my machine. I don't use a blender because we don't have electricity or aluminum or stainless steel or plastic. But I have a mortar and pestle. Some people still use it to make guacamole or to crush seeds or whatever. And you can hear it as I grind the dried mint. And lo and behold, I turn that dried mint into tea leaves.
It smells very minty. It smells wonderful.
And so this fresh mint is literally tea. So you would put the tea in a cup, pour some boiling water on it, and people say, but there's no tea bag. Originally, people didn't use tea bags. They would just put the tea leaves in water, and when they hot water, and they would steep it, and they'd drink the tea, and what's left are the leaves at the bottom. You might have heard the expression, reading the tea leaves. So when you get done, the future of you in the shape of the leaves in the bottom. So all of these plants, I have bee balm hanging, that's good for respiratory issues. I have lemon balm, that's also good for stomach aches. And then I have some willow bark. And willow bark, when you take the inner bark of a willow tree, this comes from the weeping willows. When you take the bark and you crush that and make that into a tea, drink that tea and your headache will go away. Because the chemical in this is salicylic acid, which is the chemical that makes aspirin. So in the late 1800s, the Bayer company in Germany standardizes this chemical into the pill we call aspirin. But for literally thousands of years, people all over the world were making willow bark tea to cure headaches or joint pain. Does it work? It is the same chemical. And if I had a sore throat, I would take black cherry, the inner bark from a black cherry. And that's what all of these plants are. They're effective. And as I said, the Lenape were skilled in their use, trained the man who then shared this with the settlers.
When folks are on the tour and they come in here, what are they curious about?
We get many different kinds of people here. And some people come here because they're aficionados of the 18th century. So they're interested in more technical things or more deep things. A lot of people, when they come to the apothecary, want to know about the herbal medicine. The average age people lived to back in the 18th century was 35.
Describe this room here. It's very small. There's lots of beautiful glass jars.
The room is probably 10 by 10, maybe 12 by 12, and it's about 8, 10 feet tall. And it's filled with a big chest with shelves, a hutch, I guess you would call it, that's modeled on one from Williamsburg. All right, so it was built by a local carpenter, but using the photographs of what they have at Williamsburg. And it's very beautiful piece of furniture, very large. And it's filled with bottles and mortar and pestles and containers. And I've got a couple of jars filled with black walnuts, which had a number of uses. And pretty interesting room. And hanging from the ceiling are probably 15 different kinds of plants that I'm drying and concentrating.
Yes, and I'd like to know what these plants are and were they grown inside the garden here?
Most of them were. Some of them, this one with the red flowers is bee balm, and you would make the tea out of the flowers for your chest cold. But I've got a couple of bee balm samples. Not all of them were grown here. This is yarrow, grown from the garden. And yarrow is good to mix with comfrey. You would take the leaves and mix them together and add a little water or oil to make a paste. And you put that on a cut, and the cut will not get infected. So it's antiseptic. But they wouldn't have known why. Right? We don't know about germs. So we don't know why it's getting infected, and we don't know why when you put this on it doesn't get infected, but it works. So you don't need to know the underlying science. And that was true for most of the native medicines. They didn't know about germs either, but they, over literally thousands of years, had observed the squirrels and the trees and the plants and had come to an understanding of what could help you.
Yes, I very much appreciate that and understand that. And I want to go back to those black walnuts because you said what they use those for. And the black walnut trees were probably right on the property.
We have five black walnut trees on this property. There's one at the end of the third cabin, you can see. So a black walnut produces a nut that is in a husk. And when it comes off the tree in the fall, it's green. And over time, as it dries, the black walnut becomes darker in color. If you scrape a little of the black walnut and put it in water and mix it around, the water turns black, literally black. This was used to dye clothes, to dye hair. If you make it thick enough, and you can see over on the shelf, I have a couple of quill pens. They're just feathers. That's my pen. And as the little kids that come to see this, they say, well, where's the ink? Well, you dip it in the ink. This is ink and dye. It's also medicine. The black walnut has a chemical called juglone in it. It's part of the scientific name. And juglone kills things. Native peoples observed that a poison that kills some things but not all things, that's medicine. So here's what they did with it. They would take the green husk, chop up the green husk. Inside's a walnut. You take the walnut out. They put the green husk in a solution of oil. And the oil will leach the juglone into itself. It'll take 6 or 8 weeks to get the juglone into the oil. But you've made a tincture. A couple of drops of that tincture of oil onto your tongue every day for 2 weeks, and it will kill intestinal worms in a person, but not them. It kills some things, but not everything. So this was a dewormer. Black walnuts, they're interesting because sometimes the Lenape would take the bark of a black walnut, chop it up as fine as they could get it, throw it in a pond, and the juglone will stun the fish, make them loopy. Now they're easy to catch. Black walnut, pretty amazing, right? So I can write with it. I can get rid of my worms. This is sophisticated medicine. I mean, they've created a tincture. This is very primitive.
Is there any sage in
here? Yes, there is. So we think of sage as like Thanksgiving stuffing flavoring, but it has a lot of uses. The indigenous people would burn sage, and often mixed with tobacco and sweetgrass, and they would burn it, and then it was what's called smudge room. You take the smoke from the burned sage and you put the smoke in all the corners of the room. People do it today to get rid of the evil spirits or the bad vibes. And maybe that's why the indigenous people did it, because they built most of their dwellings out of bark and tree branches and wood. So when they smudge a building, they're getting rid of the insects, all of the spiders and the mosquitoes and the things that live in this earthen material. So you smudge a room to cleanse it, yes. And maybe the evil spirits go too, but clearly the insects go. So sage was an important cleansing and health herb.
Thank you for your work. The people that come in this room are really being treated. You're such a gift to our area.
Well, you're welcome. But I just want you to know that every station here has somebody that knows as much about their station as I do. So come on here to the fort and spend a day.
A tour of Fort Delaware in the hamlet of Narrowsburg includes demonstrations of early settlers' lifestyles and craft making. More information is available on their Facebook page or their website, thedelawarecompany.org. For Radio Catskill, this is Rosie Starr.
Thank you so much to Rosie for bringing us that 4th of July special. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, the latest Star Talk. Stay with us.
It's Radio Catskill Summer Fun Drive. Make your donation now on the Radio Catskill app or at WJFFradio.org. We need your help to keep local and national news, great music programs, and life-saving information on air in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania. Give what you can. Give now, then tell a friend to do the same. Support Radio Catskill at WJFFradio.org. Thanks.
This week on CatsCast. 6 decades after the Declaration of Independence, Catskill's farmers were still living under feudal landlords.
It was really bizarre to learn for us that New York State had that very outdated system of land ownership.
The anti-rent war through the eyes of two Russian journalists and their new documentary. Saturday at 11 a.m. right here on Radio Catskill.
I'm Kimberly Izar. You're listening to Farming Country. Up next, you know what time it is, this week's Star Talk report from Keith Hubbard.
For Farming Country, I'm Keith Hubbard, and this is Star Talk. With today being July 4th, let us look at three patriotic stars, one red, one white, and one blue. Our first stop in the sky will be at the heart of Scorpius. Antares will be visible in the southern sky at nightfall and will be visible until 2 a.m. It is a first magnitude star 550 light years away. Antares is a supergiant who is near the end of its life and has swelled to 700 times the diameter of the sun. Antares will be the only red star in the southern sky, which will make it easy to spot. Next, we will turn our gaze nearly directly overhead to the constellation Lyra. Vega is the brightest star in Lyra and the brightest star in this area of the sky. It is a zero magnitude star that will be shining white. Vega will be visible all night. The star is 25 light years away. Vega was the pole star several thousand years ago and will become the pole star again 12,000 years from now. Our last stop will be in the constellation Virgo. Spica is the brightest star in Virgo and lies 250 light years away. It will be visible in the southwestern sky at nightfall and will be visible until just after midnight. Even though it is the 16th brightest star in the sky, it can be a little hard to spot. We can use the Big Dipper to find Spica. Follow the handle stars as they arc to Arcturus, then speed on down to Spica. See if you can spot this patriotic trio of stars this week. If you have any questions, comments, or ideas for future Star Talk segments, my email address is startalk@farmandcountry.org. For Farm and Country and Star Talk, this has been Keith Hubbard reminding you to keep looking up.
Thanks so much to Keith for that report. Thousands of visitors head to the Upper Delaware River, especially during the summertime. Warm weather can often bring a range of safety concerns. Radio Catskill's Tim Bruno spoke with National Park Service park ranger Susie Casper about how visitors can stay safe on the water.
The river looks very calm and very placid in a lot of places, so when you're not going through the rapids. And so people think it's really calm and you can just go in for a swim or maybe even swim across the river, which is, we actually never recommend doing that. If you're going to be in the water at all, please always wear a life jacket. We've never had a person drown who's been wearing a properly fitted, secured life jacket. So if you are going to go in for a swim, make sure you have that life jacket on and make sure it's nice and snug.
All right, let's remind folks about the top 10 safety tips on the river. Of course, number one, wear a properly fitted life jacket.
Yeah, absolutely. Life jackets are so important. If you don't do anything else, just make sure you have that life jacket and you have it on. Adults, you have to, if you choose for some reason not to wear it, which you should, it has to be within reach of you. So that way, if your boat does slip over or you fall out for some reason, you can, you know, swim to it very quickly, or you can, somebody can throw it to you if you start to get into trouble, because a lot of people don't realize that, you know, it's not like in the movies where you see a drowning person, they're screaming for help. You know, a drowning person can very rarely let you know that they're drowning because they're trying to gasp for that last breath of air. So keep a really close eye on your friends and family. And that's one of our, tips for making sure you guys have a safe trip. We've been out there many, many times, and people have, unfortunately, their friends are right next to them, and they can't see that they're struggling because everybody's having fun and a great time. So it's really important to keep an eye on your friends and family when you're out there. And then, of course, we can't forget about the little ones. So children 12 and under have to be wearing their life jackets the entire time when they're on the water. So make sure you get those kids to comply, and no better way to get them to want to put them on if mom and dad and the rest of the family has them on as well. So be a good example and wear your life jacket with your family.
Coming in at number two, watch out for ticks. And especially this year, tick season is just off the charts.
Yeah, absolutely. So you don't think about ticks because you're going on the river, but, you know, you're going to be launching at our river accesses or maybe stop for lunch. And there's a lot of, you know, high grass around, and there's deer everywhere and all the little critters that carry ticks. So make sure that you're wearing, tick repellent, or, and then especially when you get home, you know, do that tick check when you go to take a shower at the end of the day.
And stay hydrated, an important tip as well. The forecast calls for extreme heat.
It is so important to stay hydrated. So especially when it's going to be this hot and you plan on being out on the water. We always tell people which is one of our safety tips, is to file or have a float plan. It sounds very kind of technical and scary, but it's really not. It's letting your friends and family who aren't with you, letting them know where you're going, you know, on the river, when you expect to return, and, you know, just having, you know, phone numbers available just in case something should happen. They have to notify the National Park Service. Staying hydrated. So over at least a gallon of water almost for these hot conditions. But that gallon of water can also include, you know, sports drinks that can replenish your electrolytes, because when you're drinking lots of water, you need to keep those electrolytes up. So that goes hand in hand with, don't just drink water, but, you know, even though you're not going to be probably as hungry as you normally are because of the heat, but have some salty snacks like granola bars or trail mix, things like that, that will keep your electrolytes up, because it is so easy to get, you know, super just, you feel so just bogged down when it gets so hot. So keep that up. And then, of course, wear sunscreen and wear it, reapply often, especially if you're going in the water at all. So, yeah, it's so easy to get super sunburnt on the river. Wear a hat, wear sunglasses, I don't know if you've ever had your head sunburned, but it is not fun. And then your eyes, it can definitely, the strong sun, especially when the sun is reflecting up from the water, it can damage your eyes if you have prolonged exposure. So wear a hat, wear sunglasses. You know, you can, there's so many, if you don't like to keep wearing sunblock all the time, you know, there's so many different UV protectant shirts out there nowadays that people wear in pants. And they're, you know, they dry quickly if you go in the water as well.
One of the other tips is to know the signs for hypothermia and heat exhaustion and heat stroke. Can you just remind folks what those are and what they should be looking for?
Yeah, absolutely. When you start to get heat exhaustion, you know, your body is really just out of whack with those electrolytes. So you have to get these, you know, if somebody's experiencing any type of symptoms where they're just not feeling well, you want to make sure you get them out of the conditions. A real, real easy way is to, you know, if you pull off to the side of the river and you can kind of just splash cool water on someone, you know, get them cool off, fan them down. And then, of course, get them off the river, because if they're already starting to show signs of, you know, heat exhaustion, and they've stopped sweating is one of those signs as well. That's not good. And it's really interesting, because if you don't think about hypothermia in the summer months, we always think of those heat-related illnesses. But the river temperature right now is only about 70 degrees. If somebody finds, like, they're wet and they're wet all day long and they've been in the river, hypothermia can actually happen pretty easily, especially for, you know, younger children. We actually had somebody just a couple of weeks ago who had a hypothermia-related illness because it was really, really cold out, you know, for the summertime. So just keep an eye on your friends and family. If they don't seem like they're feeling well, pull up the river, you know, get help and get them out of the elements is the most important thing.
Another tip is to give animals space. And we're talking about wildlife. There's a large variety of wildlife that call the Upper Delaware River region home. Talk about some of those critters that are out there.
Yeah. So we have so many different wildlife. We have bears. We have lots of black bears. We do see them swim across the river occasionally. They're actually pretty good swimmers as well. But we see them. We have a large population of bald eagles. You get so excited when you see bald eagle, you want to scream, bald eagle, bald eagle. But, you know, it could scare them. And, of course, they have their young that are just fledging the nest right now. So they're learning to fly for the first time and they're learning how to fish. So just keep them at a distance. You know, keep your viewing at a distance and try to be quiet and observe them, because they are so beautiful. And if you're nice and quiet, they won't pay attention to you. And they'll likely swoop down and catch a fish right in front of you. And it'd be so beautiful.
What about snakes? Are there snakes in the area?
Yes, we do have snakes. So a lot of water snakes, gardener snakes. We do have rattlesnakes as well. So if you do see anything like that, especially when you're on the shoreline, I always tell people, if you're going to walk up on the shoreline at all to take lunch, it's like, especially if you're in a high grass area, I would say take your paddle with you. Just that way you can, you know, kind of put it in front of you before you take a step. The last thing you want to do is step on a snake or surprise a rattlesnake. So it's not very common that we see them, but they do exist. So just be aware of that. We also have a lot of different ducks and geese and things like that. And I know, you know, a lot of us grew up feeding the ducks in the pond bred and things like that. But on the river here, it's really important that, especially for the young ducks, that we're not feeding them. Because, you know, Cheetos, marshmallows, Doritos, you know, your sandwich from your bread is not a part of their natural diet. And right now they're learning how to forage for food. And then, so when the visitors go home, in the fall, these little ducks don't know how to forage for food anymore. So, it's really important just to leave them be. They're going to want to come and beg food from you, but please try to refrain from feeding them.
And keep your pets on a leash if you're bringing them down to the river, too.
No, absolutely. So, yeah, so both states, New York and Pennsylvania, have leash laws. And it's really just for, you know, not only for, you know, everybody else's safety, but for your dog's safety as well. It never fails that there's only one person in the access with the dog and they're running around having a good time. And then all of a sudden somebody shows up and there's a dog fight. So just please keep your pet on the leash and please pick up after them. Those little bags that we have around, those little green and black bags for the dog refuse, please take them with you, because there's nothing worse than having not only the refuse in the bag, but now we've got the bag that we have to pick up as well, and we don't want that to leach into the environment. So, yeah, please definitely pick up after your pet. And there's life jackets for dogs, too. Even though dogs are generally good swimmers, the river is strong. So protect your pets and get a life jacket for them if you bring them out as well.
And another important thing to remember is that the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River is surrounded by private, state, and federal agency property. So it's important that people stay on public land. Don't, you know, get out and disembark on private property or where there's a house.
So there is a lot of land that is state and, you know, federally owned, and there's railroad right away. It's pretty easy to tell these areas. So if you do want to pull off for lunch or just to take a rest, please don't do it in front of somebody's home. And please don't go to the bathroom in front of somebody's lawn. You know, there are several different river accesses where there are portable toilets. And, of course, our park is pack it in, pack it out. So that means that all the trash that you bring with you, we ask you bring it back and dispose of it at the end of your trip. That also reminds me that glass is not allowed on the river anymore. This has been for a couple of years now, and it's kind of for obvious reasons. You know, glass is no good if it breaks. One of our most common injuries is people cutting their feet. So wear really good protective footwear when you're out on the river, whether if you don't have river shoes. Avoid things like Crocs and sandals because, A, the glass can cut through them and sharp rocks. But also, too, they're made of very light material that floats, so they will fall right off of your feet. So if you don't have river shoes, make sure you wear like an old sneaker or something like that, and you will thank me because the rocks are sharp, slippery, there's fishing hooks, and unfortunately that glass that's you know, been in the river for some time now.
Where can folks stay informed about the river safety rules, safety tips, and conditions on the river?
Of course, our website has a wealth of information on there, so if you're planning a river trip, maybe you're not a river person, we have all kinds of other things on there where you can learn about our park. And then also we have our Facebook. We have a Facebook account and we have Instagram, and you can link to those from our website. And so if we have any type of, let's just say we have a high water event or flooding or what have you, or, you know, some sort of severe weather, we will actually update our Facebook and Instagram pages. And so you can be aware of those as well. We also have our river hotline. And that number is 845-252-7100, and we update that daily by 9 a.m. So if you don't have, you know, access to the internet, you can call that number when you get into town, and it'll give you the up-to-date river conditions for that day.
That's Susie Kaspar, park ranger for the Upper Delaware Scenic and Recreational River with the National Park Service. Susie, thank you so much, and have a great summer.
Thank you. Be safe out there, everyone. Don't forget those life jackets.
We're going to take a short break, but a paddle down the Bashakill is up next.
On this week's Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, John Cusack describes his latest project.
Well, just think of a metaphysical crime movie mixed with a kind of a drug mule movie mixed with E.T. So
right.
Think French Connection meets E.T.
Right.
Meets My Dinner with Andre meets Smokey and the Bandit.
Yeah.
Meets The Mike Douglas Show.
I'm Peter Sagal. Join us for the news quiz that's not quite what you were expecting. That's Wait, Wait from NPR.
Sunday morning at 10 on Radio Catskill. Radio Catskill wishes you a happy and safe Independence Day weekend. Celebrate free speech and freedom of the press in the Catskills and Northeast Pennsylvania with your donation to our summer fun drive at wjffradio.org.
Welcome back. You are listening to Farm and Country. Thank you so much for being here on this 4th of July. Well, we are going to stay along the water. This time, we're heading to the Bashakill. Along the Bashakill, a botanist and herbalist led a kayaking trip to teach participants about local plant life. The tour gave paddlers a closer look at the ecosystem and how to help preserve it. And along the way, the guide stopped at key points, identified plants, and answered questions. Radio Catskill's Olivia Sippel joined the group on their trip through the waters.
The longest day of the year is behind us. The summer solstice fell on June 21st, marking the start of the season with extended daylight. A day before, people gathered to celebrate. People celebrate the solstice in different ways, but many are drawn together by the same thing, a bright, lingering day that signals the beginning of summer. For me, that meant heading to Mamikating for a summer solstice paddle along the Bashakill. I rented a kayak at the Mamikating Environmental Education Center, then drove 2 miles up the road to the nearby boat launch, where the trip began. Here's our guide.
Welcome. Welcome to my home, not really, but kind of feels like that. I'm Richard Mandelbaum. I'm an herbalist and botanist. I live in Forestburg, which I'm pointing to, is about a 20-minute drive from here. And I am incredibly lucky because it was totally unplanned to live so close to what is really one of my absolute favorite places anywhere.
Richard led about 10 of us onto the water for a two-hour paddle through the Bashakil. The goal was to learn about the solstice and the ecosystem around us. Even for Richard, the Bashakil stands out.
It's something like 6 or 7 miles long from the north end out near Route 17 to the south end, and all protected, thankfully. Wetlands are so important ecologically, and this is one of the reasons I love to paddle here, is because it is ecologically and biologically diverse. It's fun to get out onto a lake, and it's beautiful. And there is, of course, a lot of life in a lake as well. But here in the marshlands, this is just rich with botanical biodiversity, with turtles, with fish, with bird life.
We covered only a small portion of the preserve, but the trip began with grounding us in the history of the land.
Now, this is all Lenape land, and Bashakil is part Lenape word, Algonquin, and part Dutch. So kil means creek in Dutch, which is why we've got so many Peekskill, Fishkill, etc. in our region. And Basha, it's a little bit, it's not 100% known, but what is the most likely explanation for that word is that it refers to a female sachem, a female leader of Lenape, local Lenape people, who, and again, history is a little bit difficult and tricky when it's been deliberately erased as well as when it's that long ago, but somebody who was involved in the struggles against colonization here at an early time. So that's what the name is, and that's where we are now.
Before setting off, Richard outlined what the trip would look like.
I will say that as we paddle through, we'll make some stops, and I'll point out some of the aquatic plants and the other things we're looking at. There's cool stuff out here. We'll see how far we get, but that is an island over there. And we'll see if the creek kind of meanders its way around, but we'll see if we get that far. It's kind of a nice destination to get to, and with a couple of stops along the way.
Then we pushed off. The sun was high, a light breeze moved through the plants, and the water glistened as the paddles cut through it. At first, we moved in a line. Then the water opened up into a wider stretch, and the group naturally gathered. Mountains lined the horizon, each peak lit by the early evening sun. That's where we made our first stop.
All right, this is our first rest stop. You can kind of pull in and we can talk about some of the things we're seeing here. If you pull into the weeds a little, usually it stops you enough so that you don't have to paddle. And you feel free to come in closer. Whatever works for you is good. If you're in a good spot, you're good.
Here, Richard explained the solstice itself and why this trip happens each year.
First of all, just to say something about the solstice itself, this has become an annual tradition for me to offer this paddle the evening either of the solstice, or in this case, it's Solstice Eve. The solstice is an exact moment. So some of you, maybe all of you know this already, but the solstice we sometimes think of as a day. But if you've ever wondered why it changes on the calendar, sometimes it's the 22nd, sometimes 21st, sometimes the 20th. It's because what the solstice actually is an exact moment in our orbit around the sun. And because of the tilt of the Earth, that 23.5 degrees that we have, we in the northern hemisphere are going to experience longer days and shorter nights when our tilt is facing us towards the sun. So we're getting more sunlight hitting the northern hemisphere. And then when we're on the opposite side in our orbit, we get the winter solstice. And of course, the southern hemisphere has the reverse, right?
He also spoke about why people continue to mark this moment.
So forever, human beings have celebrated and honored the solstices and the equinoxes, and I really encourage everybody to do that however you do it. if it's a religious or spiritual or secular or any old way, because what you're doing is you are reorienting yourself in the cosmos. You are regrounding yourself on the planet and within our solar system and the cycles that we go through.
Moments like these pull attention away from daily routines and back to the natural world around us.
Right? We've kind of lost our connection with the world around us that we have evolved in for millions and millions of years. So any ways, especially as everything gets so fast and furious, to turn things off and slow down time and reconnect to the natural cycles that we're a part of, I think is such a beautiful, healthy thing to do, no matter how we do it.
As we continued, Richard moved between kayaks, answering questions and pointing out details in the landscape. The trip doubles as both an experience and a lesson, helping people understand how to recognize and protect what's in the water around them. That includes understanding how the ecosystem has changed.
It's not a question of native versus non-native. It's really, what is a plant doing within an ecosystem? And we also don't want to demonize the plant itself, because in almost every case of a quote-unquote invasive plant in our region, barberry, Japanese knotweed, I don't know, name some others, but this is one of them, right? Water chestnut. Human beings deliberately introduce those plants, if you go back and study the history. It's our fault. It's our fault. And this is true of this plant, too. This was deliberately introduced into waterways by a horticulturalist in Massachusetts who thought it was really pretty and we should have it growing here, too. It is really pretty. It's a really beautiful, interesting plant. But, like, dumb, dude.
Later, we stopped again, gathering closely in a narrow section of the water.
It looks like orange string, right? That's what I'm looking at. That's what I'm showing you, this orange string. And it is wrapped around this plant, right? It is actually a flowering plant. It will get little white flowers on it, but it never has any green on it ever, which means it does not photosynthesize. So, like, we have probably 6 or 8 native plants in our region that don't photosynthesize at all, that have no green, that they have learned to get their nutrition by other means. And this is another one. So this never has leaves. It just looks like orange string that twines itself around. And if you catch it at the right time of year, it'll have little tiny white flowers.
He was describing dodder, a parasitic plant found in the wetlands like the Bashakil.
And so the dodder is one of the plants that has been studied for how it finds its prey, because it actually is fairly picky. It won't just choose any plant to grow on. In fact, it will spiral as it grows, looking at the plants in its vicinity to find the ones that are the most nutritious for it. And it will latch onto those plants as opposed to those plants. And we know this from research by letting the dodder plants grow between different plants. And for instance, it will always pick a tomato plant over a grass, right? Like, we can study these things.
At the final stop, the lesson became hands-on. Richard passed around a plant for us to try.
Try that. Okay. You can just try less than that if you want. I mean, it's not crazy, crazy, but... And let me come over to you guys.
Then he explained what it was.
This is called Persicaria hydropiper. Hydropiper literally means water pepper. It's surprising. It's not subtle. It's surprisingly like, oh, it's like you ate a piece of a hot pepper.
As the spice lingered, the paddle began to wind down. The sun dropped behind the mountains, casting light across the water.
And thank you all.
Thank you.
Yeah, and if you see anything on our paddle back you want to ask me about, feel free. But otherwise, we'll just head back to the boat launch.
Back at the launch, kayaks were lifted onto car ropes and the group dispersed. It's a way to learn the landscape, understand the history, and pay closer attention to the life that exists just beneath the surface. In Mammocating, I'm Olivia Sipple for Radio Catskill.
Thanks so much to Olivia for that report. That was such a fun one to listen to. And that's all for this week's show. Stay cool, stay safe, stay healthy this weekend. This show was produced by the Radio Catskill editorial team and post-production by Ronald Kelson. Stick around. Up next, it's Cats Cast with Brett Berry. You're listening to Radio Catskill, local news, culture, and NPR. I'll catch you next week.
Support comes from Damascus Citizens for Sustainability, fighting for clean air, land, and water since 2008, both locally and beyond. Information online at their Main Street storefront in Narrowsburg or their office in the Narrowsburg Union. DamascusCitizens.org.
Now, more than ever, you put the public in public media. Help keep the NPR network strong by making your gift today. Thank you so much.
Give now at WJFFradio.org.
WJFF Jeffersonville, Radio Catskill.